and we want to especially welcome two schools. We have Horning Middle School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Loyal High School. Would they please, the students please stand? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
They are in the orientation room.
Ah, okay. Schools will be observing from the orientation room as Loyal High School. Where's the orientation room? In the basement. I hope the students from Loyal, is it Loyal or Loyal? Loyal High School are standing.
We'll never
it's still an Arpentine.
We'll assume.
All of which I like. You may be seated, Loyal High School. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. This is a program started several years ago and sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case that they will hear, and they will join a justice who has been assigned for the day to speak about the procedures of the court in accepting a case and in deciding a case. They will not discuss the substantive issues of the case involved, and everyone is invited to join the students in the discussion with the justice. Will Loyal High School come up from the basement? Loyal High School will come up from the basement. Let me introduce, before I do that, is there anyone who wishes a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, please raise your hand. All right, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He will meet with the students immediately after the arguments in these cases. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Siegelman. With those introductions made, I will call our case. And for purposes of oral argument, we've consolidated these two cases because they raise the same or similar, however you wish to put it, issues. 09 AP 1579, State versus West, and 10 AP 1142, State v. Nordberg. And the way we've got this set up for oral argument, Ms. Hennick, who's assistant public defender, will have 20 minutes representing petitioner West. Donald T. Lang, assistant public defender, will have 20 minutes representing petitioner Nordberg. And then Warren Weinstein, assistant attorney general, representing the state, the respondent, we'll have 50 minutes, and then Ms. Hennick has 5 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Lang has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Satisfactory? All right. We shall proceed. Helen Hennick, representing Mr. West.
May it please the court. My name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent Edwin Clarence West. The issue that's before the court today is how to interpret where the burden of proof, burden of persuasion, or even whether there in fact is such a burden, under the new version of 980.08 sub 4, sub CG, and to some extent sub C. The statute originally was completely different than it is today. It had two criteria, and it made it clear that the burden of proof was on the state and by clear and convincing evidence. What we currently have is a statute which makes absolutely no mention of whether you want to call it burden of proof, burden of persuasion, burden of production. It's not there. It's silent. And the question for this court is, what does that mean? Now, it's Mr. West's position that given that history, this statute is ambiguous, that the clear language does not help us here. Because there is no language. What we have is a set of criteria, and there are now five of them. There were originally two of them. Two of those five criteria are essentially the same as the criteria were before. They're phrased just a little bit differently, but they're essentially the same. And three of them are new criteria that have things to do with ideas like, is there reasonable treatment out in the community? Reasonable, when you look at it, doesn't just mean is it reasonable, it seems to be tied to costs and availability, which is information that is more readily available to the state. Are there reasonable provisions for a residence, for someplace, for the person who's released to live? Again, and if you look at the cases, you can see that, at least in Milwaukee County, that's been a source of concern over the years. And the truth is that's made more complicated by another provision of the statute, which says you can't even put someone in a facility that did not exist before January 1st, 2006. So I'm assuming, based on that, that the situation in Milwaukee has not gotten any better. So that what you have to do is you have put the, if the burden is in fact on the petitioner, and remember that whatever value the liberty interest here has, we really are talking about liberty. How restricted does a person have to be maintained in a secure facility? It's a liberty interest. Now, we can talk about how much of a liberty interest, but I don't think any of us would disagree that it's a liberty interest we're talking about.
Is it comparable to being on parole? Can we use those kinds of cases?
I think it bears some similarity, but I'm not sure it's exactly the same because the underlying problem is different. When you've got parole, the liberty interest is being restricted for a different reason. It's being restricted because you have done something for which we all hold you responsible that has allowed us to restrict your liberty. I think there is some difference here because for those people who are being committed, by definition, we're saying you are here not because you've done something wrong. The concept is you're here because you have a mental disorder that makes it impossible for you to control yourself, or at least did initially, whatever, because there's obviously a continuum there.
No, I meant in terms of parole is a release under restrictions, right?
Yes, and I think to some extent the two could be compared, and it could also be compared to conditional release in NGI situations for similar reasons.
That's what I'm saying. So can you use those as to determine how much of a liberty interest you have and what kind of protection you get for that liberty interest?
I'm not comfortable using them entirely, and I think that was what I was – I think you can use them as a jumping-off point.
Okay.
And certainly there's really nothing out there in the law that tells us how much of a liberty interest this is. Mm-hmm. I know that the state has argued that
– Why do we care how much of a liberty
interest? I don't think that we do for purposes of this. I think that the point I was trying to make was not that we care how much of a liberty interest, but that as we are going through and construing this –
okay.
I think it's something that we need to keep in mind.
I thought you were going in terms of equal protection or due process.
Well, I think that it bears an interest there. And if you construe the statute to place the burden on the state, I think you have to get into what – you may have to get more deeply into what that liberty interest is. If you construe it so the burden is on the state. If you construe it so the burden is not on the person who's petitioning, then I don't think you get into that at all, particularly here. It's no different than it's always been, and we've accepted that. One of the things that happens in post.
Before you get to that transition, I just want for clarification, because you carefully, very carefully worded what you just said. When I was reading your brief with regard to is there a due process or equal protection challenge that you are advancing, if Mr. Lange's position would prevail, that is, the burden's not on anyone under the words of the statute. And I wasn't totally clear, so let me ask it very directly. If the burden is not on anyone, is there still a due process or equal protection challenge that you are advancing?
Now, the reason, I don't think so. Now, the reason it's not in my brief is because my brief was written before that second argument was advanced.
Yes, although you had it as an alternative. You said there are three reasonable interpretations, right. but the reasonable interpretation of the legislature didn't draft the legislation or didn't pass the legislation with either, but you didn't, it wasn't clear to me in reading the constitutional challenges whether or not that was incorporated. My best guess was that it was not, but that's why I'm asking for clarification.
I don't believe it is, because I believe the heart of the constitutional problem, and I'm a little less sure on the equal protection, because certainly you would be treating it differently than we treat conditional release. You would be treating it differently than we treat Chapter 55 or Chapter 51. So I'm not sure that that interpretation would completely answer the equal protection.
But you are not advancing that argument here today for this court.
No.
If the, let me say, middle ground for use of shorthand is accepted. Is that correct?
That's correct. Where I think the problem comes in is when you put the burden of the release with criteria that require information that is not in the hands of the person who's supposed to put it forward. In the sense that there is no discovery, there's discovery as to treatment records. There's no discovery as to what facilities, for example, does the department have available. If I ask them and they say, we're not going to tell you, I get nothing on costs, and yet I'm supposed to propose that this is cost-effective or can be met by reasonable cost.
Well, there's a fourth alternative, and that is some of these criteria are on the petitioner, some are on the state.
Certainly, I think that interpretation, which I haven't thought of till now, would be an offshoot of what Mr. Nordberg is arguing, that would be a possibility. The question, of course, when you've got a statute like this is what did the legislature intend? And the problem, frankly, that I have here is that there's not really much to hold on to that helps you with what the legislature intends.
Ms. Hennig, if you've got a statute that says the burden's on the state, and then you've got an amendment of that statute that's silent as to the burden being on the state, is it not reasonable to assume that the legislature no longer wanted to place the burden on the state?
Well, the problem that I have with that analysis is that if you've got a legislature that has a statute that says here's where the burden is, the legislature presumably recognizes that there's a need to distribute the burden and then doesn't do it. Does the fact that they don't do it mean that they wanted to change it? If you wanted to change it, wouldn't it have been very simple to simply say, unless the petitioner proves the following things? They certainly had that language in front of them for the state. So I'm not sure that you can presume anything from it at all. The problem that I have.
Is there any legislative history that's helpful one way or the other?
I was unable to find anything. And I didn't notice in the state's brief that the state was any more successful than I was in finding legislative history, other than history being the statute said this at this point, this at this point, and this at this point.
Counsel, I don't hear you today being real strong on the idea that the state bears the burden of proof. Are you still advancing that argument?
Personally, my position is that the state bears the burden of proof. But I've gotten increasingly confused the more I've looked at this statute is the problem that I'm having.
Thank you for that, because it's a be careful what you wish for, right? If you want to make it the state's burden to prove the five criteria, why would the state introduce those things? Those are all things to help him get out or her get out.
Well,
the state could stand silent. The state could not introduce the evidence or not introduce strong evidence. I mean, if you're the proponent of wanting to get out, shouldn't you show why you want to get out? I mean, before it was clear, like Justice Crook said, the state had the burden. The state had a burden to prove this person still belonged locked up, essentially, okay? But now that's gone. And it says, and I'm a trial court judge, you know, sitting here saying, the court may not authorize super release. I cannot authorize this person's release unless the following five criteria are met. And you're saying you want the state to have to prove those criteria to prove that the trial court should release the sex offender.
Well, I guess the question is, there are two ways you can look at this. One is whether the state's duty is to try and keep him locked up. Or the other is one that has been proposed in this court before, and I remember hearing during the Schulpius argument, which was that the state is interested in the treatment of sex offenders. And when you look at it from a treatment perspective, that decision becomes different. Because from
a
treatment perspective,
I have had a number of 980 cases, and there are times where the state's expert comes back and says, this person no longer qualifies for a 980 commitment. That's rare.
It does happen. Yes.
But it is rare. But I'm saying to you, if I'm your client and I have to rely on the state to prove that I get out, that causes me great consternation.
But if I have to prove things where the information is in the state, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. If I am not to be allowed to get at the information I would need to prove this, it makes no difference as a practical matter.
Well, can't you hire investigators and expert witnesses who can tell you that?
Well,
give you all the information you want?
I really wish it were that simple. And the problem that makes it very, very complicated, and this is what we saw in Milwaukee County when we went through Schulpius and Morford, is that when you put it in terms of reasonable, and I can defeat it by simply deciding something isn't reasonable, there is, unfortunately, a huge political component to it. When you add to that the provision in the statute that says I can't use any facility that did not exist by January 1st, 2006.
What does that mean?
I have no idea. I didn't even see that till last night.
The group home that was in existence before, is that a facility?
I am assuming so. I don't know whether that simply means if we're going to put him in a transitional housing, if we're going to put him in a group home, if we're going to put him in a halfway house, or whether that means if we didn't have a supervised apartment here, we can't do it. I would assume that's not a facility.
Is facility defined?
It is not defined that I saw.
I have another question. Is supervised release a constitutional requirement in Chapter 980, either under Carpenter or Post or the U.S. Supreme Court cases?
I believe that it is. When you look at Post and you look at what this court relied on for the idea that it was rationally related to its purposes, and remember those purposes are partly safety, but the other part of it is treatment. And we knew it was related because of the nature and duration of the treatment. And one of the interesting things, and it is in the records here, is that treatment as envisioned at Sandridge has four components, the last of which is some release to the community under supervision, because the idea is that when you're treating someone with mental disorders, that you want to ease them back into the community, that you don't just send them out there discharge them and withdraw services. That's not a treatment model. But in any event, to go back to Post, there were a couple of things that this court relied on. And one of those was, and if you look at page 314, so it would be 197 with second, 279 at 314, was that there were periodic mental examinations to determine whether there's sufficient progress. There's no point to those if you're not going to have something that you can transfer them to. That's one of the things you relied on. And when you talked about double jeopardy in Carpenter, one of the things that was relied on was that there was a choice of placement, which is no longer true. That was on page 266. There was provision for supervised release plans. Those things are very tightly linked. If there's no supervised release, then you are undercutting some of the reasoning for finding that this was not double jeopardy. You are undercutting your reasoning that this bore a rational relationship to its purposes, primarily its treatment purpose. So, yes.
What about the concept in Foucher that that indefinite commitment without the state proving whatever the criteria are is not constitutional?
Well, I think that it's related to that as well, and I think that that's one of the things that this court was looking at in Post in determining how do we say whether this is a component and what components do we look at. So I think that the two definitely do go together.
Counsel, I want to take a look at the third element of the five factors, or the third factor, treatment, and that is, I'm referring to 980.084CG, treatment that meets the person's needs and a qualified provider of the treatment are reasonably available. Does that refer, by implication, to placement on supervised release?
I think that it certainly has been read that way, and I think that it does, because what you're saying is, because otherwise, certainly, that would always be met, because treatment that it meets the person's needs is available, at least initially, at Sandridge. And if it's not, to say you don't get out on supervised release because the treatment you need isn't at Sandridge would be backwards, it would seem to me.
Well, I guess this comes to mind as a follow-up to the Chief's question, which in part was, is supervisory relief
constitutionally necessary?
And your answer was that yes, it is, because it is part of treatment. The two purposes for 980 are, number one, protection of the public, and number two, treatment. And Post and Carpenter said, you know, without treatment, the constitutionality is, it's unconstitutional. So my question then, is it number three or number five or both that reference the need to show placement?
Well, what gets interesting about number three from that perspective is that if you look at the model of treatment that Sandridge talks about, where there are four phases and the final phase is supervision out in the community, what happens is that at some point, theoretically, I don't know whether they didn't testify in this particular case, but you get to a point where treatment that meets the person's needs is not available in Sandridge because you cannot provide that component. So whether this means that or this means treatment is available in the community, I don't know what the legislature meant. I don't know how much they had in front of them in terms of what the model was. But certainly you can reach a point where treatment in Sandridge, by the expert's own opinion, is not adequate because it is missing an important component. I see my time is up.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel. Mr. Lane.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Don Lang appearing on behalf of the respondent appellant petitioner, Glenn Nordberg. Mr. Nordberg's case is here on a petition to bypass from an order denying a request for supervised release. And as the Court's well aware, the real issue here today is whether, in the face of a silent statute, Chapter 98008 can be construed to place the burden of persuasion on the respondent patient and the magnitude of said burden. It's Mr. Nordberg's position that, consistent with the plain language of the statute, that the burden of persuasion isn't assigned to any party in these proceedings, but rather a supervised release hearing, much like a sentencing proceeding or a dispositional hearing in a termination of parental rights case, is essentially a discretionary determination by the trial court that is guided by a wide range of information, as the statute recognizes, and is guided by specific factors that the court's required to take into consideration in rendering that decision. I believe this construction of the statute, frankly, is true to the language of the statute, is basically really reasonably follows from the judicial nature of the proceeding in this instance, is consistent with the broad range of information that the statute anticipates the court will be considering, and frankly is consistent with the nature of what really are some policy decisions that are set forth in those five factors. When I first addressed this issue, and I happened to represent Mr. Rochelle where this came up, on appeal, my first thought was both parties seem to be operating under this false assumption that there's only two options here, either the burdens on the state or the burdens on the respondent. And perhaps I'm just a contrarian, but it struck me that those aren't the only two options available. The difficulty is, once you adopt those two options as your governing premise for your arguments, you basically force the court to engage in judicial legislation. Because from the respondent's position, you basically have a statute that has removed language placing the burden on the state, and you're left to argue that, given the history of this provision, where the burden has always been on the state, that the court's going to have to infer that the legislature must have just made a mistake and not included that burden. And in the end, ultimately, given the sparse, non-existent legislative history on this point, the court's left to speculate that that's what the legislature meant to do. On the other side of the equation, the state's position, frankly, is even more tenuous, because essentially the state's position is, well, we took away the burden placed on the state, but what you should do is infer that this legislature wanted to take this great leap and put the burden on the respondent. And even though that's never been part of the statute, even though that conflicts with the way we treat NGI commitments and other people seeking conditional or supervised release, but somehow, even though the legislature wanted to make that great change, they somehow forgot to put any language in the statute to effectuate that intent. And then you look down the statute and you realize, well, there is burden of proof language under sub 8 when we talk about revocations, so the legislature knows how to put this kind of burden language in. If you look to other statutes, such as sex offender registry statutes, there is an exemption provision, and in the 30145 component of that, the burden is expressly put on the person seeking the exemption. Curiously, under the juvenile code, where there is different policy considerations, there is no burden of persuasion assigned to anyone, but rather the court exercises discretion based on the list of factors to be considered. The factors are pretty much the same, the context is different, and the legislature reasonably took a different approach to sex offender registration for adults, sex offender registration for juvenile committees.
You know, let me walk through this a little bit. You get in the petition, and then the court says, okay, I've got this petition for supervised release. And then within 20 days, the court says, okay, I have to order an examiner. I can order one or more. And then the examiner examines the person, looks at their records, looks at what treatment records are available, looks at facilities that are available, and then is required to provide the court with a report on if the person believes they're proper subjects for release, type of treatment and services a person can need and will need while in the community on supervised release, and the county pays for the cost of that report. That's a court report. It's a report to the court. So then the court sets it for a hearing, and then here the statute says a court can't authorize supervised release unless, based on all the reports, records, and evidence, the court finds the following criteria. So how does that court report factor in to your analysis, if at all? Does that mean you're right? I mean, should the court just take that report and say, look, I can't order supervised release because the examiner doesn't suggest that that's appropriate? And this is the person that answers Ms. Hennick's question about, you know, my client won't have access to what treatment is available. But this person who reports to the court does. And it's not one side or the other introducing, it's just a court report that the court reviews. And then should the court just decide it based upon that one report? Or what do you think should happen? And if something happens, do you think it's just you get three experts who come in and they all testify? I mean, you're not going to present an expert that doesn't support what you want to have happen, right? So you're going to present your side, the state would present their side, and then the court has the court's report. And then, I mean, there's just no burden. You just sort of say whatever the court thinks that day?
Or? I think the statute anticipates a broad hearing in which a wide range of information is going to come in. The court report is but one thing. Whatever expert the patient wants to put in, you could call, you know, treatment providers from the institution to identify how the defendant performed or the respondent performed. In Mr. Nordberg's case, a probation parole officer who supervises 980 patients was brought in to describe what they've done in another case. Now, the universe of people supervised was one, so sometimes it's hard to get a sense of what resources might be available.
But the court at that hearing, I mean, that's a big deal. I mean, the court has its own report, but then you have everybody presenting their side of what should happen. And it's not like on that particular day the court says, you are going to go to this place for sure and live in this house at 2323 West Wisconsin or whatever. You don't do that. You authorize then the department to prepare a report suggesting what places are available, and then it proceeds down that path, which was, you know, the problem in Milwaukee, because the court actually got to that point, but they didn't find a place for him. But I'm just trying to see how that court report factors into the arguments that have been made, because the court does get information on what's available and if they're a proper candidate for supervised release.
Yeah, and the report is one factor that the court can consider. I think the statute refers to reports, case file, evidence. So somehow evidence is a separate entity from reports and case history. Or
I mean, typically it's a lot. Right. I mean, it's two sides arguing and the court report. You know, I mean, it's not like you come in there as a judge and you don't have any information. You have a lot of information, but it's not the judge's job to put them in a specific facility after that hearing.
No, I mean, there's another step that occurs. I mean, I think this revision of the statute in part was a recognition that this is a really important decision, and the legislature wanted to be sure that when a judge makes this decision or this decision is addressed in court, that certain factors are looked at and considered. Now,
are these facts? I mean, usually we talk about burden of proof relating to facts. I know we have a burden of proof relating to constitutionality of a statute, but that's very separate, too. So what are facts here? Is it a fact that the person's progress can be sustained while on supervised release?
Well, that's closer to a fact than the reasonable resources. Okay. I mean, if you were to assign a burden of proof on that, that's a moving target because it's a fluid situation, because what's reasonable will depend on the peculiar circumstances of each particular patient's situation. It may turn in part on what the current budgetary situation is for the department in the county. So, in effect, that determination is sort of the classic policy decision that sort of fits like a 90403 balancing abuse of discretion, prejudice. The judge basically has to exercise a policy decision of what is reasonable and whether the reasonable resources can meet this particular person's needs.
Well, is it a fact that he can be reasonably expected to comply with the requirements and the conditions?
And again, that's closer to a fact, but essentially how that plays out would be opposing experts would offer their opinions of whether he's capable of doing it. Now, there's, again, an uncertain component to all this, and that is what exactly will be that treatment that occurs out in the public. One of the factors, for instance, is whether the person will comply with rules set by the court and the department. Well, the problem trying to prove that is the patient at that point in time doesn't know what rules the court's going to set, so whether or not the person can comply or prove they can comply with those conditions or rules is sort of a nebulous concept because they haven't been established. The court who's reviewing the case will have some notion of what rules or expectations they're going to impose and can base a decision whether they expect this patient can meet those based on what the judge feels is going to be appropriate. But the patient can't know in advance of the hearing what it is the judge is anticipating as a proper order.
Mr. Lang, 2005 Wisconsin Act 434 is what amended this 980.084CG, is that right, or created it? Do you know what else was amended in Act 434?
Oh, goodness, I'm trying to remember everything. Off the top of my head, I can't.
Well, for example...
Several portions of this statute. I can't remember if Aaron's, the discharge statute, was amended as part of 434 as well. I believe it might have been.
Well, it's... Section 980.09, petition for discharge, that section was amended by 2000 Act 434, but I don't know what it is. Are you familiar with subsection 4 of 980.09?
You'll have to refresh my recollection.
Well, subsection 3 is the one that puts the burden persuasion and the clear and convincing evidence on the state. Subsection 4 talks about if the court or jury is satisfied that the state has not met its burden of proof under 3, the petition shall be discharged from the custody of the department. If the court or jury is satisfied that the state has met its burden of proof under sub 3, the court may proceed under 980.084. So, what I'm trying to figure out is, if we're under 980.09, the state has the entire burden there, clear and convincing evidence. And if it satisfies its burden, the court may proceed under 980.084 to determine whether to modify petitioner's existing commitment order by authorizing supervised release. Now, how does that interplay with your argument?
A variation of that provision has been in the statute from the start. And there's always been this recognition, I think, consistent with Ms. Hennick's comment about what is good treatment. And for some individuals, it's transitioning them from the institution to the street. And this provision recognizes there may be some people who aren't eligible yet for a complete discharge, but they may be suitable candidates because they've made enough progress and they pose sufficiently limited risk that supervised release is the appropriate placement for them at this point in time.
Okay, but now sub 4 is going to include all that stuff in CG.
Yes, I assume so. It'd have to be the same factors.
The state has brought in a lot of evidence to sustain its position that there shouldn't be a discharge. Okay, and the court may now go to sub 4 of 8008-4. Once the court goes to that, whose burden is it?
It's back to my position, there is no burden. There is no jury any longer. The jury made its decision on the discharge issue. I didn't ever envision that that determination about supervised release was going to be a jury determination. That it's purely a judicial function then, and there is no burden of proof. In fact, I was trying to imagine how you would ever take the supervised release proceedings with all the factors, and in fact, factor one actually has four subparts in the definitional component, and try to construct a jury instruction that incorporated all those variables. It would be virtually impossible.
But what I'm really asking is this 98009 sub 4 second sentence consistent with your position or inconsistent with your position?
It's totally consistent. I think it's just a procedural mechanism in those cases where discharge was deemed not appropriate to now consider supervised release because they're two completely different inquiries.
Yeah.
One is absolute release without any further supervision, completely exempt from any department control. The other, you still are in actually for the first year, a house arrest, essentially, and getting treatment in a supervised placement.
Isn't your answer, in part, that what is being proved under 98009-3 is different than what has to be proved under 98008?
That is absolutely correct, yes.
So that if the state cannot prove 98009, it's a wash as to what happens under 98084 because you have different standards. In 98009, the state has to prove, that the person's condition has changed so that the person doesn't meet the criteria for commitment as a sexually violent person. That is not at issue, as I understand it now, under 98084. So you've got two very separate distinct proceedings with two very separate kinds of issues to be proved. So the burden of proof as to one needn't carry over to the second.
Absolutely.
One of the positions you and your counterpart counsel over there advanced in using 980.09, I think, sub 3, dealing with discharge is, hey, you said in a legal way, hey, it's going to be easier to get a discharge than it is to get supervised release, and that makes no sense. I didn't recall that you were the attorney on what I call State versus Rachel. You called it State versus Rochelle, apparently.
Yeah.
Did you represent Mr. Rochelle?
The last round. Yeah. Actually, I think his first round.
How does he pronounce his name?
Rochelle.
But that's a case where 4 days after the Court of Appeals case came out and said you don't qualify for supervised release, 4 days later, he was discharged.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
it took me by surprise.
yeah. So, I mean, and that's the argument advanced in your briefs. You said your argument is consistent with what Justice Prosser said, but I think also your position is consistent with the interplay. But your argument in your brief was the state's position is kind of inconsistent because the state's position, putting the burden of supervised release on the petitioner, gets kind of an absurd result of making discharge easier than supervised release. Now, my recollection is your counsel pushed that more than you did, but that you made some reference to it also.
Yeah, I don't know that I even mentioned it, but I sort of agree. As a practical matter, what's going on in the real world is that. It's an easier to prevail in a discharge than it is to try to prove all these various factors. I mean, I have great sympathy for the private practitioner who gets appointed to do a 980 supervised release hearing and would have to try to show what reasonable services are and what resources are out there. Where do you begin to try to identify what those resources are and, you know, pin down who you call in to testify on the subject? I mean, it just strikes me this whole inquiry really is a judicial-type inquiry that balances all these factors. And when you throw in terms like reasonable amount of this or reasonable amount of that, it's a really just almost unworkable to try to prove that element. And I also see that my light is on, so I will pass.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal also,
Can the court appoint its own expert in this kind of a hearing?
I assume it could. Generally, they wouldn't. Resource issue, I assume. There's the department expert, and then the respondent usually has an expert appointed.
In all such petitions, is counsel appointed if the petitioner does not have funds?
Yes.
How many of these are a year? Do you know?
Well, I have to tell you. That's a very good question. The total number in the history of the provision, there have been 95, I believe, supervised release grants.
Since what year is that?
1995. There's been one this year. I think there's been 38 revocations of supervised release. Let's see.
How many petitions did you say?
Petitions? I don't know how many petitions total.
Well, you just gave me how many supervised releases?
The total grants of supervised release orders over the history of the provision is 94. This is data from legal counsel from the DHS. They don't know how many of those are actually contested because, in my experience, most of the supervised release are situations where the person's close to discharge and there's a stipulation to supervised release. And I think the department, in many instances, prefers that route because that way we have a transition of the patient rather than just cutting them loose. But I see I'm way over my time now.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Weinstein?
May it please the Court. I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, and I represent the state in this action. I think there's one thing that we certainly can say for sure from the history of the statute, and that is, as Justice Crooks pointed out, the legislature did clearly mean to remove the burden from the state where it had been since the inception of the statute. We've gone through some 8 various revisions of the statute over time, and until this last 2005 Act, it has always been on the state. So it's clear, it seems to me, that the legislature intended to remove the burden from the state. What's not clear is whether or not Mr. Lang's position is the correct one or whether or not there is a burden on the petitioner, the supervised release petitioner. And I must admit that Mr. Lang's position is quite attractive, both at first blush and ultimately for the state in terms of a litigation. I think the major problem with it is that from a practical matter, as far as the burden of production, somebody has to go first at this hearing. And so you have to have, it seems to me, a burden of production on somebody, even if it's just you're the one who has to go first. So in that regard, to say there's no burden creates a problem for trial courts. And the second problem with it, which is very similar but much more problematic, it seems to me, is that if you have these criteria with the language of the statute as it is, that the circuit court cannot authorize supervised release unless it finds these 5 criteria. And when you consider how that's going to play out on appeal, which is, we've always used a sufficiency of the evidence type of, or at least since the since supervised release was removed as an initial option, we've always used a sufficiency of the evidence approach in whether or not the record supports the circuit court's decision. It seems to me that what you end up with is the circuit court has to make these findings in order to grant supervised release, and there has to be evidentiary support for that finding in the record. And if there's a contested fact in one of these, or one or more contested facts in these five criteria that are required, then it stands to reason, at least in my view, that the person is going to have to convince the court that their particular view of the facts or their presentation of the facts is the correct one. And then that's essentially a burden of persuasion.
Well, isn't reasonableness under these circumstances an exercise of discretion?
Well, it interestingly enough, when the statute was first passed and there was an option for supervised release at the initial commitment stage, this court held that that was a discretionary decision in State versus Sprosty. When the legislature removed that option, then this court looked at the, there was no burden language in 06. 980.06 was the operative section at that time under the initial version of the statute. Once that language was removed from 06, giving the circuit court an option of supervised release, the only supervised relief provision that remained was the one with the burden. And so, naturally, this case came up again to this court on how do we determine whether or not, how do we review a supervised release finding under 08, and the decision was, in I think it's State versus Brown, that we use a sufficiency of the evidence test, which makes perfect sense. But what it does is it removes any discretionary type ruling on the fact of the on the part of the circuit court. You can put a discretionary element into supervised release if you look at C and CG in sub 4 as being independent. You can then say, if the court makes all of the findings in CG, then it still retains a discretion of whether or not to grant or deny supervised release under sub 4. A number of my colleagues, when I was preparing for this argument, indicated to me that they didn't think that was much of a difference, because if you're able to meet all the five criteria in CG, how on earth could you ever find that in your discretion as a circuit court that all the factors in sub 4 weren't also met? And I have to admit that that does seem to me to be problematic. But nevertheless, the structure of the statute does allow that kind of an approach.
Now, under supervised release, the state can keep someone in commitment even if the person does not meet the criteria of a sexually violent person. Isn't that right?
No.
Okay, why not?
Well, there are three ways that supervised release can come up. Two of them involve filing a petition. One can file a petition independent of anything else.
Right.
One can file a petition as part of or after, most typically it comes after, but it's not required to be, the annual examination. What happens a lot of times in those instances is you get both a petition for supervised release and a petition for discharge. And if the petition for discharge is judged under Aarons to be insufficient to require a hearing, then the court would go to the supervised release petition. And the third way is the way Justice Prosser pointed out, which is if you actually go to a discharge trial and the state is successful in demonstrating that the person is not entitled to discharge, the court can then consider supervised release under that provision in 09, which provides that after the discharge trial, the court has the authority to authorize supervised release under sub 4. And I would think that in most of the time, the circuit court's going to require additional evidence, because I'm sure most circuit judges are not going to want supervised release kind of testimony in a trial for discharge, because it's really not very relevant, not relevant at all, really, as the Chief pointed out. And therefore, it seems to me you really are involved in a two-step process if you go through a discharge trial and then a consideration of supervised release. It's going to be very much, it seems to me, like a NGI proceeding in which you go through guilt first, you get a result on guilt, and then you determine whether or not the person is responsible. So, well, but in all three of those instances, if I could just a minute, all three of those instances, there's no question of the continuing validity of the commitment. Either the person does not challenge that by just filing a petition for release, or the court or the jury have just determined, either by rejecting a petition or by a trial, that the commitment is still valid. So we have here a situation where someone is not eligible for discharge. If somebody's eligible for discharge, I think it would be error to put them on supervised release, because they're just, that's unconstitutional. That is unconstitutional. O'Donnell and Fuqua tell us that.
Plus, you have the period every 12 months the court gets a report on whether this person should, it meets the criteria essentially or not.
And
you
know, that,
so
and
you have not only the supervised release petition, the discharge petition, and they can petition for supervised release every 12 months. They can petition for discharge. But aside from that, if no one petitions for anything, the court is still going to annually get a report at least every 12 months on how this person's doing and whether they still meet the criteria. So if the person does nothing, the court still gets a report every year.
Right. The court still gets the report. One of the changes in 05 was that under the old procedure prior to 05, the court had to actually consider that report if the committed person didn't sign a written waiver of a hearing. Under the current procedure, the court doesn't have to do anything with the annual report unless the petitioner, unless the committed person files a petition for something, which most of the time they do, but the court's not obliged to take it up on its own. Nevertheless, you're absolutely right. The court gets a report every year, and under 07, which is the authority for those reports, the department is required to provide the information for the criteria for supervised release. So I think it's incorrect when Mr. West says, oh, I don't have any ability to come up with this information. It may not be particularly easy, but first of all, the DHS personnel are required by 07 to provide some of that information. Many times it's sketchier than anybody would like, but it's there. And the other thing is, there's nothing to prevent the personnel at Sandridge or anybody else in DHS from testifying at these proceedings. The state is not part of DHS. They're a separate entity in these proceedings, and many times would disagree. So, as Mr. Lang pointed out, the petitioners can subpoena the treatment people from Sandridge. They can subpoena the examiners from Mendota. They can subpoena the personnel in DHS downtown that do all of the scouting out of where people might be placed, and put that evidence in. Now, many times that doesn't resolve the problem, as this Court's found out in a number of occasions.
As in Sprosty, as in Schulpius, as in Castillo, as in the Court of Appeals in Krieger. You've been around, I think, for most of those where we can't find placements. The counties
well,
can't find placements.
Well, at least in Milwaukee, that's true.
Well, Sprosty was not a Milwaukee, to my recollection. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right. He wasn't.
Yeah, that's right. I want to return back to the language of the statute, because that's really where we have to, I guess, begin, right?
Right.
I start with the premise in the law that the legislature knows what it is doing. And I think that that is not only a legal premise, but I really do, in fact, start with that. They know what they're doing. They're setting the policy. You have a statute that in the prior iterations of the statute had that the state has the burden and the standard or level of burden is clear and convincing evidence. 2005, that language is gone. It is reasonable, as you suggested and as advanced by question earlier, it's reasonable to assume the legislature intended to take that language out. That language, I think of something like out of sight, out of mind, you know, but who had the burden? And what the burden was is not something that was out of sight, out of mind. It was right before them when they were changing from the old to the new. It was right before them still in 980, I think, .093 on discharge. I mean, the language is all around. So it is reasonable, I think, to argue that if the legislature wanted to put the burden, they would have written that because they know how to do that. And I look at the language of the statute and I say to myself, okay, what level did the legislature adopt? Clear, satisfactory, and convincing? Well, you can't find that there. So it's hard for me to embrace the argument, unless we start writing in words, that the legislature adopted in 980.08 sub 4 CG, a standard of clear, satisfactory, and convincing. Make your argument that the legislature adopted that in CG.
I was quite surprised when the Court of Appeals reached that conclusion. But
okay.
I have to say that in terms of defending the decision, if you look at the criteria for clear and convincing that has been held sufficient for clear and convincing in the past, for instance, the taint of fraud or the taint of being someone who's been convicted of a forfeiture action or something like that, that certainly the decision, the importance of the decision of whether or not to put someone who has been adjudicated as a sexually violent person, and where nobody at that point, at this point at least, disputes that that committed person is still sexually violent, to put that person out in the community is a very important decision.
Yes, but your argument is this, as I hear it. If the legislature were going to adopt a standard, clear, satisfactory, and convincing is the standard it should adopt. But in response to my question, where can you show me in the language of the statute that is what they adopted, I think your answer is...
There isn't any.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And that is correct. I think, and the case law says this, that the level of the burden is a policy decision, and sometimes the courts have to make it because...
It's not in the statute.
Right.
Also not in the statute is, and the burden is on the petitioner or the committee or respondent or whatever you want, I mean, the normal respondent. That's not in here either. Now, I can say oops, legislature made a mistake, because it should have been, it wasn't out of sight, out of mind. It was right in front of their face. They just got rid of the state having the burden and what it was. They have it just a little bit below this statute. It's right in their face. So either they made a mistake when the language is really right in their face, or not putting the language in is what they intended.
And I think that certainly is I think Mr. Lang's position is a reasonable one given the language of the statute. But as I said, the real problem with it is that whether you say it or not, I think the way the statute is structured, there is a burden of going forward on the petitioner, and there is a burden of persuasion on the petitioner, because that's the only way evidence gets in that is going to support a circuit court's finding of the five criteria. And if there's a contested issue, that's the only way you're going to get a circuit court to make a finding favorable to supervised release, is if they're convinced.
Why?
And so I think the fact that it doesn't say, now the level of is a different question, but the fact that it doesn't say it doesn't mean there isn't one there.
Let's take a look again at the language of the statute, and let's look at the five factors. As I see the first two factors, and I get this from marking up pages 4 and 5 of your brief, where you nicely set out the two statutes, the old and the new. And when I see on page 4 of your brief the new statute, and you have number 1, and that deals with progress in treatment, and number 2 deals with the degree of a probability or the probability that they won't engage in future sexual acts so those are the two areas 1 and 2 cover. And I look at the old two factors. They're set on the bottom of page 4 and the top of page 5, and they deal with the same thing. Number 2 on the top of page 5 deals with the degree of progress in treatment, the same thing that's asked or addressed in number 1 of the new statute. And the same thing is true with the old statute when it in number 1 asks about whether or not there's going to be future acts of sexual violence. That's the question or the issue addressed in number 2. So I understand there's a positive and a negative going on, but the area is the same. Future sexual acts, degree of progress. And so I see those two as covering the same territory. It's 3, 4, and 5 that add specificity. Stop me. Do you agree with me on that or disagree with me on that?
I think that's correct, that the first two criteria are
the
essentially
old two, just
the same
inverted
as the old, and that there are 3 new criteria.
Yeah. When I responded to you earlier, giving a little litany of the cases that you've participated in, at least in Sprosty, and as I said, Krieger was in the Court of Appeals, and Castillo, and then the Schulpius, and there are others, but those are ones that come to mind. Placement. What resources available in the community for placement was an issue in all of those cases, and in all of those cases, there was no real acceptable placement, and that was a problem, at least. That's the way I saw it. I mean, certainly Sprosty, you couldn't get anyone to do it, and neighboring counties, not either. Let's address 3, 4, and 5. Which one of those, is it 3 or is it 5, that deals with the resource of placement? What's available for placement as part of the treatment component?
Five. I've never seen a supervised release transcript where there was a dispute about whether treatment was available in the community, because we're talking about outpatient psychological treatment. And that has never been a problem that I'm aware of.
I guess if I take your premise that that's what we're talking about, outpatient psychological treatment, I've read a lot in preparation for today, and I tell you I can't point to it, but some case, some brief, and I've read a lot, advances that placement in the community is part of the ongoing treatment. In fact, if I recall, and it was, I think, in Norberg, when in the history he talked about the four levels that Sandridge does the evaluation at, and Norberg only reached the second level, but that they consider, this is coming back to me now, they consider that placement in the community is part of the treatment. That's where I think I get that.
Well, I think they view that as the progression someone goes through before they sufficiently reduce the level of risk to be discharged.
I think that's one way of saying it, but I think they said it was treatment.
But I think they are, the fourth stage is contemplating sex offender treatment in the community the way it's performed with persons who are on parole from sexual offenses.
Let's take a look then at five, since you seem to think that's more focused on a resource of a placement in the community. How is a petitioner going to provide that information?
Well, I think they can do the same thing that the state does, although they can't. The state has some resources that it has, money, essentially, that it can go out and solicit placement, places to put people. With the exception of Milwaukee County, the department has been relatively successful in either getting private halfway house type placement or in some instances private rental property with where the landlord is willing to make security arrangement changes and so on. That's what Mr. Lang's data, the 95, indicates. That it is difficult, there's no question, everywhere, but it's not the kind of impossible situation that we've seen in Milwaukee County.
When he was reading that data, I didn't know if it was part of the record, but what comes to mind is one in, so tell me if it is or isn't, you know better than I, if it's part of the record. But what came to mind was one in the last year, and you've got the difference in the change of the wording in the statute to from before 2005, that the court was required to do supervisory release as opposed to the different language now. And so 94 or 5 overall, but I'm wondering if the change in the 2005 statute language really diminishes any possibility of supervised release.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I'm sorry. Do you think the language of the 2005 statute diminishes the possibility of supervised release? Not just from a resource point of view, but...
I don't. But the problem, this has always been troubling to me, ever since, because it's always been the same structure in the statute, which is the circuit court makes a decision about whether or not somebody should be on supervised release before the court's really aware of what's available in the community and how difficult is it going to be to provide sufficient security to safeguard the community.
And isn't that what five is?
They've always had the statute's always had the cart before the horse in that regard, and this hasn't changed it. So, does this make it difficult? Yes, it does. It's always been difficult, and it's always been difficult because the court is kind of in the dark here.
Well, because at the hearing, the court makes a determination of a residential placement would be appropriate. But then they order further examination of what the options are out there. That's where Sprosty and some of those other cases came in.
That's right.
That's talking about that issue is really putting the cart before the horse, I think, because under 980.08, the court has to decide if this person is a proper candidate for supervised release. If they are, then it's up to the county to figure out where they're going to put them. But that shouldn't necessarily hold the day. If the county says we don't have a residential placement facility, then the court and the county get into it because the court ordered that, so they've got to figure it out. That was the issue in some of the Milwaukee cases. But that didn't impact whether the court in the initial instance ordered supervised release. The criteria in those instances were met, and then it goes to the next level. It's sort of like in a criminal case. You can't sentence someone before you have a conviction, right? So you have to have the initial determination. Is this person a proper subject for supervised release? If the answer is yes, then, like I said before, the judge doesn't say you're going to live at 2323 West Wisconsin. The judge says, county, figure out where they're going to live so that it meets my order. That's how it works. So to talk about, you know, what if there aren't proper places, that isn't the determination the court's making at the supervised release program. They're determining in a general sense, is this person someone who can be safely within the community and no longer is a sexually violent offender such that they need to be institutionalized? The court determines that at the hearing, but the court doesn't determine where they're going to be staying.
Well, that's... It has an approval.
It has no.
The department submits a plan to the court for approval.
I know. I've done it.
Right. I mean, the department, the DHS, in cooperation with the county, is the one that determines whether or not somebody or whether they can place them at a particular location.
Right. But I mean, the point I make, I'm probably the only person sitting up here who's done these kinds of hearings or had 980 cases, I think. And possibly Justice Gableman at the end, but I don't even know. But in our neck of the woods, we had a number of these. And so to me, this is a real, you know, how does this work and how do you make it happen? And to somehow say that you got to find the exact place where this person's going to live isn't the analysis. I mean, you've got to put aside sort of that and decide, is this person a proper subject for supervised release? That's the analysis. Then the county prepares their reports. So to say somehow that you need all that information at the time you're making the initial determination just isn't the way it works.
I think that's clearly the structure of the statute, yes.
Counsel, let's take a look at what the words of the statute provide, what the legislature intended, and look at sub 5 as I was doing. A reasonable level of resources. What does resources mean there? Does it mean just money or does it mean availability of placement?
Well, it's mostly money, but I don't think it's limited to that. I mean, there have been instances, I think, where people have said, well, this person can be placed on supervised release if we have a person to go to be with them 24/7 wherever they go and so on and so forth. And sometimes that's a money problem. Sometimes that's a problem with getting enough personnel. It's sometimes a problem where a person can be placed at a particular location, but the electronic or whatever kind of monitoring that placement has is insufficient, and they are or are not willing to upgrade to take the person. So it varies. It's It is certainly money-driven.
Yeah, that's money and availability of other resources that can be purchased by money. Yeah. That's the way I interpreted number five, too, a reasonable level of resources. Money, people, if they need 24/7 supervision, if they need placement, these are all resources, depending on individual cases and locations.
Right. Including treatment, which is one of the connections between three and five.
So who is to, how does this play out in terms of who should be responsible for the burden of going forward as to the available resource for placement, if that is part of the resources, the available resource if they need 24/7. Who is responsible for bringing that information, or are both responsible?
Well, certainly the incentive is on the petitioner, because, as I pointed out, if the petitioner doesn't ensure that there's sufficient evidence in there from which the court can make a defensible finding on appeal, the petitioner's going to lose. And so that's why I say, whether or not you say it, there's a burden of production on the petitioner.
Mm-hmm. Well, then,
I think if you just look at it in terms of the information, then I think Mr. Lang's view is workable, because certainly in that process of holding the hearings, if you don't worry about who goes first and if you don't worry about who has to convince the court if there's contested evidence, all of the information gets to the court, and the court could then just make a determination based on the evidence it has before it about whether or not these criteria are met.
This information is really mostly in the hands of the state, though, regardless
well,
of...
Well, I don't think so, but I separate the state and the department here, because the state is represented by the district attorney and by us, and we do not always agree with the department.
Okay.
Fair
enough. Let me put it in the negative. This information is not as readily available to the petitioner as it would be to either the state or the department.
I think it's very readily available to the department. I think because the petitioner has the ability to subpoena anybody in the department as a witness, that it is available to the petitioner, and the petitioner's counsel can certainly call the same people I can call or the DA can call to find out what they know. Now, it may be that the department hasn't done the work and doesn't know anything, but that's neither of the parties' problem. It unfortunately falls on the parties, but it's not the parties' responsibility to actually develop the evidence until after the decision is made, at least if we're talking about placement. I have seen instances where petitioners have gone out and hired their own person to scout out placement options. I certainly have seen evidence of that petitioners have presented at hearings dealing with outpatient treatment. So it's not quite accurate to say this isn't available to the petitioners. It, as with any burden, if the burden is on you, it is more difficult for you than for the other party. That's always the case.
Justice Presser.
Justice Bradley asked you a question about whether Act 434 was designed to make supervised release more difficult. And I think you said no. What was the purpose of Act 434?
Well, 434 was some very sweeping changes into the entire structure of 980. So it did this change in supervised release. It changed the statute to put in the language that this court considered in Aaron's last term. It changed the method of appeal from a normal civil appeal to an appeal under 80930. It changed discovery from normal civil discovery to criminal discovery under 971. I can't remember. There were other changes. Those were the major ones.
What do you think the changes in supervised release, what was the purpose of those changes?
In part, I think it was a perceived problem by the state and by the department and by some, maybe all, of the legislators that the default position of supervised release, given all the problems that we had seen in placement, was not the way to go. I'm less certain about whether or not they really meant to create a burden on anybody. As I said, I think Mr. Lang's view is a reasonable one. As a matter of practicality, I think it does still envision a burden because you kind of have to have one. Now, they may be narrow areas. Well, one isn't. Going forward with the evidence, you just have to have that because there's no other way to do hearings. But when you talk about persuasion, sometimes you need it and sometimes you don't.
It seems to me you started out by saying the burden of persuasion was taken away from the state, that clear
the
and
burden, yes.
Taken
and,
away.
And with it, I think, the burden of going forward.
And it seems to me a little hard to come to a conclusion that at least on some of these things, the respondent isn't required to go forward to make sure the court has some information. Does this create some constitutional problems?
I don't think it does. And the reason is because I don't think that supervised release is constitutionally required, either under due process or equal protection. And I don't think that a non-released person who is committed has a protectable liberty interest.
Say that last sentence again, please.
I don't think there is a constitutional problem with placing the burden on the petitioner. I'm sorry, go ahead. And I might say
a non-released. Say that once more.
A person
not discharged.
Someone who has been committed,
yeah,
validly committed, I think has only, as with parole, has only a unilateral expectation or desire for treatment outside of a secure facility. I do not think that's a protectable interest. If you use parole as an analogy, Greenholz holds that there's no protectable interest in a desire to get parole. Once you have a parole granted, and I think it's true, if you have supervised release granted, there is a limited liberty interest in not having it revoked without appropriate due process standards. But I don't think before you get that status, you have a protectable liberty interest. I think the analogy to parole is a good one. And in that regard, the conviction, in this case the judgment of commitment, extinguishes the liberty interest and allows the state to confine somebody within the scope of the judgment, which is in a secure mental health facility. Now, if the person no longer meets criteria, then they're entitled to total release, no supervision, no commitment.
Mr. Weinstein, do you have any statistics that might tell us how many people have been released outright since the inception of the Act?
I don't. I have a kind of a gestalt about the number, and it's in the area of 35 or so.
Considerably less than supervised release.
I think so. Okay. But maybe Mr. Lang has those facts, but I don't. I could find them out.
How many people have been found to be under Chapter 980?
Since the inception, and I'm not sure the exact figure, but since the inception, it's in the neighborhood of 350.
So out of the 350, what is that, 10% released outright?
I'm not sure.
Roughly.
I think it's roughly 35 or 40.
So that would be about 10%.
About. I don't know. Do you have the data, Don?
So, if I might, under sub 5, under CJ, it's your view that the petitioner would have to set forth evidence about a reasonable level of resources and set forth evidence about the level of residential placement or supervision and treatment that he is required to have. That's right.
Yeah. Usually the way that comes in is through expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's...
I'm assuming that the expert is a psychiatrist or psychologist or some other expert in the mental health field or in... the treatment field for sexually violent people. Because the assumption is that he's sexually violent, right?
Yeah, that's right. And usually, well, there's evidence from either treatment personnel or other personnel from Sand Ridge.
Right.
And
but they're not going to have resource level.
Persons too.
They're not going to know about the resource level.
Well, what they can usually testify to the way I usually see it in transcripts is that the expert will say, I think this person would require personal.
Got to see the doctor three times a week for
right.
5 years.
If you're talking about treatment.
Yeah.
Or they'll say, we don't think this person could be released outside of a locked facility without an escort, or they might say, this person really needs inpatient treatment. Those are examples of testimony.
And do they testify as to the reasonable level of resources?
That's the one that's difficult, I think, and that's where I think you'd have to rely on department personnel. They're usually the ones who know that.
Right, and if the department doesn't know it, then. And as
usually,
you said,
but
that's
possible. They usually have, because they have these things come up a lot, they usually do have, and again, setting aside Milwaukee County where it's more difficult to figure it out, they usually have some sense of whether or not there are resources in a particular county.
72 counties?
Yeah. I mean, they usually work with the county. Mm-hmm. 51 boards.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of their annual report that they file every year. They have to go
right.
through
it's
these five criteria
there.
And explain what's there. These right. five, not different ones, these criteria.
Yeah, the statute specifically requires that to be in the annual report.
I did a little research into the legislative history, and some of this statute and some of the changes go back to a legislative council committee.
There was a legislative council on this.
But according to my research, which may or may not be sufficient, when it got to the legislature, significant changes were made.
As I recall, the legislative council focused mostly on trying to develop placements outside of the secure facilities, but I don't remember totally. I didn't find anything, as Mr. Lang and Ms. Heineck have said, I likewise didn't find anything that was particularly helpful about it.
Well, there was a long discussion. I think that it was the legislature that decided that DHS and the state were two separate entities.
Well, I can tell you that the way that's come up is that we have disagreed many times with what DHS has decided they want to do. Sometimes we have to go out and hire our own experts, both for diagnosis and for dangerousness assessments. Sometimes we disagree with them and have used them as adverse witnesses in placement. So, and I mean, if you look at the statutes, DHS has no statutory authority to represent the state, doesn't even have any real steps. Well, has authority to sue and be sued, but that's the extent of its authority in terms of legal.
State entity, though, isn't it?
Well, not all state entities have that, but they do. But
I mean, it is a state entity. But that's because you represent the prosecutors.
That's right, we do. And the prosecutors represent the state in the trial court.
That's right. And the DHSS theoretically represents the treatment aspect.
That's right. And they at times come with their own lawyers to these hearings.
That's right. They're not represented here today in either one of these proceedings.
No, because they're not normally a party. They're not considered a party to the action.
Mm-hmm.
May I ask, 980.08.4 CM has a provision about the court may not select a county where there is a facility in which persons committed to institutional care under this chapter are placed unless that county is also the person's county of residence.
I think that was put in specifically for I think it does predate the Sand Ridge facility, but it applies to Sand Ridge. But I think it was primarily put in for Dane County and Outagamie County, because when that part of the statute was adopted, I'm doing this from memory, I'm not positive about it, but when that part of the statute was adopted, those two counties were concerned that because the facility that housed folks, which was Mendota Mental Health and Winnebago Mental Health, that there would be a desire to have these people placed in their county merely because that's where they were when they were in the secure facility. I think that's the reason that subsection's there.
Well, it's also to counterbalance against the sentence preceding that, which says, unless the court has good cause to select another county, go to the county of residence. Well, good cause might be that the person is at a facility in that particular county.
Right,
they knock that out.
Right. They can stay in Winnebago or Dane if that's their normal residence. So I think what the concern was that these counties only be responsible for people who were committed and who were residents of their county, not that they...
They want to spread these people around the state.
Well, at least back to their county of residence, yeah.
Right.
Let me see here.
Justice Prosser?
I haven't been a circuit judge, but it seems to me the circuit judge cannot place somebody on supervised release in any county except the judge's own county where that person is a resident, and cannot place anybody in a facility that was created after January 1st, 2006.
As Ms. Hennig pointed out, that language has changed. I didn't look at it specifically for this case. I do know that at one time, there was a provision that if, under supervised release, if it was impossible to place someone in the county of residence, the court could select a county and order placement in that county. And that came up in the first Sprosky case. But as far as I know, that's never happened. And I think it's very possible that that's no longer in the statute. I'd have to look to be sure.
There's no absolute requirement in the statute that the court who makes up the plan and that the plan require that it be in the county of residence.
That's the preference. The county.
It's not in the statute.
I'm sorry?
It's not in the statute, I don't think.
Again, I didn't review those parts of the statute for this case. The plan, and I don't think this changed, the normal situation is where the county, after the court determines that supervised release is appropriate, it directs the department to develop a release plan. And the statute used to provide, at least, that the department work with the county board to come up with a placement. That plan then was presented to the court for approval. But the court did not actually make the plan itself. That was the responsibility of the department.
Mr. Weinstein, doesn't it bother you that the constitutionality is upheld as treatment, not punishment, because they've already served their prison term, and yet this statute moves from civil to criminal, that the method of appeal is from civil to criminal, that discovery in civil, which is very wide, is now moved to discovery in criminal, which is narrow?
Given the developments at the U.S. Supreme Court determining how double jeopardy works, no, it doesn't bother me.
Double jeopardy issue. Well,
that was the concern with originally Carpenter. Having civil discovery, having all of the civil trappings, was the legislature was very concerned that this would be viewed as punishment, especially with the Halperin, I believe, was the U.S. Supreme Court case.
Which one?
That Halperin, which seemed to say that that if there were too many criminal trappings, it might be punishment. Well, the Supreme Court has backed away from that. It's looked at since even before Hendricks. It looked at the statute strictly as a statutory interpretation and whether or not the legislature intended a civil statute or a criminal statute. And if there were sufficient civil purposes and so on, then the statute was to be considered civil. And Hendricks did a good job of going through all of that. And so I don't think at this point we would arrive at the conclusion that just because we're going to use the 80930 procedure for appeals, which has some reasonable reason for doing that, because what we were seeing was, because of the way that civil appeals work, the notice of appeal had to be filed and then the case had to be remanded back to the circuit court for hearings on ineffective assistance of counsel and stuff like that, it just made sense to put it in 80930. And likewise, the discovery, which in my view was a much closer case, but I come from some of a civil litigation background, but I have to say it was very difficult on people in public defender's office who were not used to civil appeal, civil discovery, to do these cases with civil discovery, and both they and the DAs wanted a criminal discovery. And I think from a point of view of the people who are trying the case, that makes perfect sense. So, no, I don't think it bothers me. It does not, I don't think, convert this civil statute into punishment, which was the big concern.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? All right.
I'm just going to address one point very quickly, and that point is, in fact, the discovery issue. The point has been made that, well, you could simply subpoena people from Sandridge. And I will tell you practically, you know, the problem with that is that because there's no civil discovery, and I, too, come out of originally a civil litigation background, trying to identify who the person is who has the information to do this kind of a hearing and put in number five, whether there are reasonable resources, is going to require multiple hearings. I'm going to have to get the first person on the stand to say, oh, well, I have this piece, but such and such has that piece. Then we're going to, so I'm going to be asking for a continuance. We're going to move ahead. We're going to do that. Because one of the things I've learned over the years is, number one, who has what information and is in what position at Sandridge is not static, just like in any other agency. Number two, that just because I ask who's in charge by calling up doesn't mean they're going to tell me. And if I do get the information, because they're not under oath or anything else, there's no guarantee that the information that I'm getting is accurate. Sometimes I can get reports on things, then it's clearer. But it is a practical problem, specifically because of this lack of discovery. If there were discovery, I think that Mr. Weinstein is right. It would not be that big a deal. Without discovery, it is doomed to try and get that information.
Did the public defender's office support moving from civil to criminal discovery?
I was not aware of that piece. I was aware, as one of the people who's done a lot of 980 cases on appeal, of the discussions about whether to change how the appeal went.
Mm-hmm.
I'm well aware of those discussions. The discovery, I remember being asked about it. I remember thinking it was a bad idea, but I'm sure there were a lot of people asked, and that if there was, in fact, a decision made, I'm not even clear that it was. I'm not doubting Mr. Weinstein, but I don't remember it, and I was not involved in that piece of it.
Okay.
I'll try to briefly answer a couple of questions that have been posed and then move along to a couple of substantive matters. First of all, a question was posed about number of discharges. Since 95, institutional discharge total is 63 from Sandridge institutions. 43 of those are in the last 2.5 years. And as a practical matter, what happened is there's new data for the actuarial instruments, which substantially lowered risk values, and so a number of people who had been committed based on the new data simply didn't qualify any longer. And so I think that accounts for the vast number of these individuals. The question was posed about due process rights, liberty interests, and I guess I would strenuously disagree with counsel for the state that I don't see parole as being comparable to a 980 commitment. When a person's convicted of a criminal offense, they forfeit their liberty rights because of the conviction. Parole is purely a matter of grace that the state affords. A Chapter 980 commitment or any civil commitment derives from your status and having a mental health problem and being dangerous. When that status changes, the state no longer has an interest in retaining you or detaining you. The length and nature of a commitment is contingent upon the person's mental condition. It's a fluid factor, not a static one. While it may require a conviction to get into the 980 commitment process, you are not being punished or lose your liberty because of the conviction. It's because of your mental status. With regard to the burden of proof, obviously it's my position there is no burden of proof. And I think the lack thereof doesn't somehow render these proceedings somehow just a hopeless mess. We have sentencing hearings and TPR dispositions all the time. There's no burden of persuasion, but yet the judge isn't left there uncertain what to do.
Who goes first?
What's that?
Who goes first at the hearing?
I don't know that it would matter.
What's on second?
Never mind.
I don't think it would matter. I mean, customarily, the government usually goes first in these proceedings, but frankly, it shouldn't make a difference. People know what the standard is. The standard is set forth in the statute, so it's a matter of presenting information for the finder of fact to make the decision.
Well, you say there's no burden of proof. Burden of proof has two components, burden of production, burden of persuasion. When you say there's no burden of proof, are you using that term in both concepts?
in effect, if the respondent doesn't do anything and the state doesn't present information on the topic, he's not going to get supervised release. So there's an incentive, certainly, by the respondent to come forward with information. But the respondent may not have all the information. In fact, as has been discussed here, some of the information may be more readily in the hands of the government.
You don't use respondent and petitioner. Who, in the original proceeding for supervised release, who's the petitioner and who's the respondent?
Well, in the original proceeding, the government's the petitioner. And this has been always so interesting. The petitioner in the supervised release proceeding is generally the patient, though it could be the department.
Could be, but generally.
It's generally the
okay. And the respondent is the state of Wisconsin?
I guess it would be the state, yes. In terms of these types of hearings, and perhaps I was influenced in part by reading a couple good sentencings lately, and there was sentencing where the trial judge, when confronted with some factual disputes, said, this is important to me. I need to resolve this factual question. I assign both parties to gather information on this subject, and we will adjourn and come back here and resolve this. That's how I envision these hearings could possibly go. It may well be, because of the diverse policy nature of some of these decisions, that that's the appropriate result by a trial judge. And I envision that the legislature was trusting trial judges to do the right thing. And there may well be situations, because the parties won't know what factors the judge will consider important in terms of conditions, that the appropriate response during this hearing would be to adjourn and ask the parties to provide the information. That may entail advising the government to find out who in DHS knows so that we could find out what the appropriate information is.
Well, if there are facts, then don't you usually have to have a burden of proof for facts?
Well, no. In sentencing all the time, in TPR proceedings, we have evidence presented. There's findings that occur, but we don't have a burden of proof. And I guess, let me just say, my sense of what would happen with this new proceeding as the legislation has been revised is we'd have to revisit State versus Brown, because I think essentially we'd have an abuse of discretion, erroneous exercise of discretion standard on review. Now, it may well be that there'll be some disputes down the road as to what the factors that a trial judge is supposed to consider, and we may have to clarify the meaning of some of these factors that are set forth in the statute. But I think the standard of review would switch from a sufficiency standard to an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. One thing is clear, sometimes suggested by the state, well, these are important decisions, and these are potentially dangerous individuals, and therefore we can somehow infer that the legislature must have intended the most onerous obstacles, even in the absence of some language directing the adoption of those obstacles. There is no rule of statutory construction that's unique to 980s that provides that when the legislature is silent on an issue that we can infer that they must have intended to impose some burden on the respondent patient.
Don't you really think the legislator intended to make it harder for supervisory release?
I guess I don't know what their purpose was. They certainly spelled out more specifically what factors they thought were important. Whether they thought that would make it more difficult or not, I don't know. I think as a practical matter, it does make it a bit more difficult.
Okay.
In and of itself. And that's apart from any assignment of a burden of persuasion, and certainly a burden as strenuous as a clear and convincing standard. Clear and convincing standard has been applied as an exception. The natural burden is a preponderance when it's unstated. And it has been applied, as counsel for the state notes, in important matters, but those important matters usually are matters where the government is seeking to impose some quasi-criminal sanction as opposed to a criminal sanction, the fraud, misconduct kind of claims.
Well, you know, I noticed in 980, in regard to revocation of supervised release, it doesn't say who has the burden, but the state's the petitioner there. But it does say the burden is clear and convincing evidence.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's any other way to a person wouldn't move to revoke themselves. So I assume the government would have to be the moving party there.
You think
would have that burden.
The burden is on the state there. by clear and convincing evidence?
You know, in terms of...
Your red light is on, so you should wind up quickly.
Oh, I will stop myself now then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Ms. Hennick and Mr. Lang and Mr. Weinstein for excellent briefs and interesting and excellent arguments on Chapter 980 in its revised status at the moment. We've had many 980 cases, and statute keeps changing, and the arguments keep changing. And I want to thank you all for doing a wonderful job for the court and the clients. With that, 09-AP-1579, 10-AP-1142, State v. West, and State v. Nordberg. The hearings on these cases are completed, and the court will be in recess until 1:30, at which time it will go into closed conference. Justice Gableman will meet with the students, and the students from Loyal High School should come up from the basement to the second floor east hearing room. With that, the court is adjourned for at least the so far scheduled May arguments.